Gaming on the Frontier. This is Bruce.
This is Trav.
And this is Jonathan.
Welcome to Gaming on the Frontier, your podcast of finding out whether you're Buck Rogers or who's the pirate.
Well, there's Han Solo. There's Captain Malcolm Reynolds.
No, there were Black Bart, Black something. Oh. Yeah. Anyways, welcome to Gaming on the Frontier. This week we're doing something a little different. We decided that we wanted to basically entertain ourselves when we're not doing this podcast, amongst all the other games that we're doing, and we dragooned Jonathan into being our GM. And we said we want to do a space game, but of course, being who we are and what this show's about, of course, it can't be like a product, you know, a game that's already published. No. We have to create at the very least, our own setting. Okay, so this is the Gaming on the Frontier space adventure game, you know, for want of a much, much better name for it, which we'll work on. But let me see here. Your questions here. High-powered or low-powered characters? I don't know how to answer that question because it depends on the system. In Savage Worlds, you start off as really low-level characters, but it doesn't take much time to get up to where you're legendary.
I guess it was more of a question of, like, how gritty and how likely it is to die or fail. Like, do you want to go in already being, like, masters of your craft and being able to handle most situations with relative ease, or do you want to be having to, you know, scratch and claw just to survive, or something in between?
I would like to think that we are of the, you know, what you consider to be like a
reasonably competent.
Well, you know, more than just barely competent, basically professional level. So if I was to put it, I would say that no more than a 25% chance of failure.
As long as you're sticking to your specializations.
And anything we try to do, yeah, as long as we're dealing with something that we are either well-trained for or whatever. I mean, really, that's probably 25 is a pretty high number, but, you know, it's an adventurous game, so therefore.
That's basically 3 out of 4 times you'll do what you set out to do, yeah.
And the fourth time, it isn't like sudden death. It just means that there's a complication that's going to get in the way. Now, of course, when you add up all the different things that you have to do, then maybe that there's going to be a lot more complications. But I'm just saying, though, is that this thing where there's a 50-50 chance of doing anything correctly is way too low of a chance, you know. And
yeah.
Because like in D&D, you know, the number you're always trying to hit, they don't say it. They're not honest about it, but it's 15. You're always trying to hit 15 or better. And so, because like, you know, when you add your bonuses onto your die roll, you know, usually the number you're trying to hit is 15. So, and I'm just saying is that, you know, 10 is the average for a 20-sider. So people it's hard for them to get, you know, I'm saying in D&D, there's a lot of failure. Okay. And that's trying to balance the game so that everybody has a chance to shine rather than just a few people always doing the successes, you know. But I'm just saying is that for a small group like us, I would like there to be a lot less chance of failure, but, you know, I would like the failures to be, you know, not failures, but complications as a result of story elements. Like, yeah, you're doing this. You're doing a good job flying the ship. Oh, there's pirates. Or, oh, you know, there was an accidental hit with a you know, with a piece of space debris, or you didn't do enough because of something you did in previous mission, you overstrained a part of the ship, and therefore it's failed, and now you're going to have to, you know, fix it, or you're going to have to figure out some way of getting it fixed, you know, or it's going to take you longer to get to where you're trying to go, and that's going to cost you money because there was a time clause, you know, in your contract, you know, things like that. I'd rather not be like, you know, the chance of sudden death, I would like to be pretty darn low.
Right. Yeah. I would like to have us, okay, we are known for our skill sets. We have a reasonable amount of, I would guess, reputation. Oh, yeah, you're that one pilot that did the slingshot maneuver around the moon back a couple years ago. And yeah, things, we might be known. We might have some notoriety in our field. We're not the top of the list, but...
You're not legends, but you're not schlubs.
We're not Delta Force, okay?
Oh, there was something else I wanted to bring up. It had to do with technology. Robotics. Yeah, are we gonna let's see what we had here as far as...
Well, we talked about cybernetics. Did you want to talk about the AI? Because I did put a special note about that.
Well, AIs and just robots. Are we going to be having, like, let's say, salvage? Most likely, we're probably going to be having, like, drones go fly it over there and, you know, pick through that wreckage, yeah. But are we going to be having...
If you look down at my list, I suggested that there should be things like salvage drones that are designed to identify valuable parts of a ship or a complex and go in there and remove them, you know, and bring them back. You know, so we don't have to go out there and do, you know, EVAs just to go and strip down a husk of a ship that got taken out by pirates or other nasty doers. Because those would always be traps, you know.
Yeah.
Go fetch me those parts.
Pirates, you know, could put bombs on ships. Sending a drone out there is a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, so they could, and so the drones could be totally automated, which I'm fine with, at least within certain abilities. Or the drones could be Waldos, essentially, where we're in it. You know, we're on the ship, but we're looking out through it. And only under certain rare circumstances would we actually do an EVA to go out and to another ship. Like, for example, if we're, you know, if his ship is intact and just floating in space, and that's a huge salvage find, you know, we might not want to strip it down. Maybe we could take the ship and fix it up well enough that we could, you know, send it back and make a big payday on it. Or there could be people that could be still alive on the ship if it was sending out a distress signal. You know, that's where an EVA would make sense. But I still think we'd send a drone over first to, you know, to check out, you know, at least the way the ship looked on a closer detail. And if it was mined, then that would be a, you know, they would blow up the drone and not us.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about, you know, we're not, you know, I'm not talking protocol and R2 unit level robots, but just most likely our robots will be things like, oh, the EVA drone or, yeah, something like that. So we're not going to be having them as like NPCs. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't see anything like that. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the way I looked at it I kind of decided that there wouldn't be any general AI, no sentient AI. There's no smart robots. There's some that seem smart that if that's what they're made for, you know, there's chatbots. This is, you know,
it's just very good programming.
Yeah, it's very good programming.
One of the most one of the best uses I ever saw with robots was on a show called, I think, Almost Human, and they had these, you know, they had fully functional androids, but most of the police force, they had these robots that were these big tall guys, and they had like twin machine guns on one side of them. And so when the police officers would go out with them in pairs, okay? And if somebody fired on them, then they would return fire. But the police would basically shelter themselves behind the robots, okay? As they would move forward with the robot taking the brunt of the damage, you know, and
I'm seeing kind of like, oh God, it's the Anthony Mackie Netflix movie, Beyond the Rim, where they had the robots, the Gumps, that's what they called them. Yeah.
I'm kind of seeing the Tachikomas from Ghost in the Shell.
Well, those guys were amazing.
Yeah.
those were true AIs, and you sat in the back of it, in the back.
Fair enough.
Yeah, yeah. In the place where the spinneret would be used, you know, that was where.
Well, I think at least in the show, I think the government had some dumb ones. I think only Section 9 had the smart ones.
Well, that's a good thing, because if you watch the show, you found out that every 30 days they had to wipe their memory, because otherwise they became truly sentient and would try to take over the world.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I think they end up saving the world at one point.
Oh, they saved the world sentient, a lot of times, because they weren't at the end. They weren't in late term, you know, robot, you know, AI, where they said, really, we should be in charge. Up till then, it was like, yes, Major, no, Major. We love you. You know, meanwhile, every month they're getting wiped down to the beginning again. Anyways, that was one of the storylines that I thought was very interesting. I think it might have been one of the movies. But, okay. Self-aware but dumb AI is fine. You know, we're not... Nobody's trying to, nobody wants their robot to be arguing with them or their AI to be arguing with them. Just the facts, please. You know, is the ship can't, we don't want any of this, you know, the ship can't take it no more, Cap.
No Scotty maneuver where you say it's going to take 5 hours when it's really only going to take two, just so you can seem like a miracle worker.
Yeah.
They did a really good thing on, the old Tom Corbett Space Cadets book series, where in like the very first one, they're in, you know, the academy, you know, and they made Tom Corbett the captain of they were doing war games. So basically, you know, half the crew, you know, half the people in the cadet corps have been split into two groups, and he's the captain of one. And though, so he's like, it's like capture the flag. You have to capture the flagship of the opposing fleet, quote fleet, you know, and they were all basically small ships, small patrol ships that they were training for to be part of the solar patrol. But, and so what he does is that he goes and calls down to his engineer who on the power deck, and he says, hey, Astro, no joke. Name is Astro. He says, you know, we have nuclear powered engines, and you have to run it through a coolant in order for it to, before it comes out the back. And he says, yeah. He says, what if we ran it through only half cooled? And he says, well, you know, that's going to tear up the lining of the jet tubes, but on a short-term basis, I guess it's fine. And so because of that, he was able to get like 50% more power out of a certain number of ships, and they were able to basically see the enemy and jet over and capture the enemy before, you know, they could get surrounded by their defenders and neutralized. So I'm just saying is that the ability to basically say we can push these parts of the ship beyond their stated limits is a good thing. And I think we should be able to do that. Not saying that there can't be a chance of failure, you know, because that's also a part of pushing. Okay, but, you know, that's – and, of course, there would be consequences like higher maintenance, you know, more, you know, things having to get replaced, you know. But I'd like to be able to do that, because that's a cool thing you can do in space, in science fiction type stories, is to be able to say, well, what if we did this?
And what if we went back? What if we went past the recommended specifications?
Yeah. What if we dumped half of our water supply, you know, into the fusion engine, you know, and burned, you know, 10% longer than we're supposed to, that, you know, that would maybe allow us to outstrip the pirates that are chasing us, what if we, pumped up our lasers, could we get through that really thick armor it turns out that there's a pirate dreadnought, and it's so big that it doesn't use fusion engines. It uses the Orion engine, which is nuclear bombs dropped out the back and blown up, it's a big massive ship, and so it would take a ton of engines to get it. You know, when you want that really quick acceleration, the engines that are on are not going to do the job. So you have this secondary method. You know, you shutter up the engines to protect them, and then you deploy this big, huge plate, and you set the bomb off next to the plate, and it gives it a big push. You know, so I'm just saying things like that, you know, are cool things that you could do. You know, so unless you had that kind of option on your ship, you know, then you could outrun most ships, knowing that their engines, based on, you know, their sensors, is whether the size of your ship means they're this mass, their engines are this type, you know, based on their emissions. Therefore, we know they have a top acceleration of Y, and if we can get Y plus X, we can outrun them. But it might mean we have to, like, you know, burn. We either have to go end up coasting toward help, or we're going to end up having to spend something like life support, you know, to get ourselves
diverting one system for another, yeah,
away from something else. So, you know, that these kind of storylines I want to be able to do, because I think they would be cool to do that, you know, like, yeah, and of course, you know, the ability to take those robots and break them apart and mix them back together to the specific needs of the mission is also a good thing. Okay, so that's kind of like what I was, you know, thinking about there with robots and hacking, well, not hacking, but basically building what you need when you need it, you know, from what you have. Like I said, the
repurposing your technology.
Yeah, the ultimate, of course, is Captain Future, who, from a few devices on his body, he's always able to make whatever device he needs in order to win the day. Hamilton, Captain Future, if you haven't ever read them, they're old. You know, we're talking 40s, 1940s, but they're great stuff. So, all right. So what else do we have here? All right. So one of the things that I have, I wanted to talk about was, how do we want to handle things like combat? Or, you know, or navigate. When I say combat, I mean, like, yeah, so ship handling. All right. I would like that to be as transparent, and secondly, as quickly as possible. So the way I looked at it, as I said, was that it seemed to me like there were four parts to it that should each require a simple role. And then you add up those roles, and they turn into a modifier that would be used on whatever it is you're trying to do. So the first thing was, and this might be for multiple people, would be one, combat awareness. You need to know the state of the ship, positioning and heading of other crafts, or whatever the hazard is that you're dealing with, and their condition, so that you know what's the best choice to make as far as your reaction to that. Then the second thing was navigation, plotting the best course for what it is, whatever it is you decide to do. And the third thing was engineering, which is, can your ship do what you want to do? You know, what is its capacity, and can it be pushed? You know, are the shields still up? Or, you know, are our lasers still working? Because if our lasers aren't working and we can't fix them in the next round or the next couple of rounds, then we should seriously start thinking about running. Okay. Then, of course, there's piloting, which is to take that plotted course and try to reach it while avoiding weapon fire or other things like that. And then finally, weapon fire, being able to fire at your targets, whether they be enemy ships or incoming asteroid or whatever like that is concerned, while possibly these other maneuvers are happening. So that's what I'm saying, is that you might need combat awareness on multiple things, you know, because the pilot's going to need it, the shooter, the gunner's going to need it, the navigator's going to need it, okay? The engineer, you know, doesn't need to know that. They just need to know their ship, you know, what it can do. So that's how I saw it, but it has to be quickly resolved. So at the most, like, rolling four different colored dice, you know, and then adding those factors together, you know, and basically using that as a quick modifier on perhaps an overall general roll to succeed or fail, or maybe just a target number that you're trying to get a bonus to. I don't know. This is something you're going to have to deal with, Jonathan, because it depends on the system you decide to use, you know. Because, and that's also why I recommended that you check out the chase rules in Savage Worlds, because first of all, it has nothing to do with the rest of the system.
It's its own little beast.
It's really its own little game. Yeah, its own little thing. You're taking cards, a deck of cards, and you're handing them out to people, and basically, you know, your card, you know, your card versus their card of your enemy tells you how well you're doing, whether you're getting an advantage on them, whether you're ahead of them, whether you're behind them. Because, see, that's why I put the listing on, like, where, you know, depending upon what you do, what your navigation, okay, is going to affect things. Because if you're trying to take out the enemy ship's sensors, or their weapons, or their command pod, you're probably aiming for the front of the ship, so you want to be face-to-face against that ship. If you're trying to come up from the rear of the ship, assuming, of course, they have no rear weapons, okay, then you're probably going for the ship's power core, because that's usually at the back of the ship, you know, possibly their propellant tanks, you know. If you go from the side, then, you know, that's usually you're trying to hit the main body of the ship, which means you're trying to either just, you know, rupture cargo holds, or you're trying to kill people who might be passengers, or you're just trying to make the ship generally unlivable. But,
yeah.
So I'm saying is that depending upon which direction you come across a ship is going to determine what you're trying to do. And of course, you should have that determination ahead of time, saying, well, I want to do this, so therefore this is the direction I want to go, and therefore that's where, you know, you do it. There was an old game a long time ago which had biplanes, and you had like two decks of cards, and basically you'd go and you'd get a hand of cards that had these maneuvers of going right, going left, doing an immobile, flipping over, and then you'd put those cards down, and then you'd look up in the book, their card versus your card, what the result was. And sometimes you'd see, like, you know, the ship over to the side, you know, the biplane over to the side. Sometimes he'd be above you, sometimes he'd be below you, and sometimes you were heading straight on, which is what you wanted in a dogfight, because all of your machine guns were in the front. So the only
yeah.
But of course, they're firing at you at the same time you're firing at them, so if you had the advantage, though, you got your shot off first, and maybe you'd take them out. So this is kind of like we want some kind of ability to do essentially a space dogfight without it being like traveler number crunching.
Ah, okay, yeah.
And FTO 2448 really wasn't any better, you know, when it came to actual combat, you know. So, you know, we need... That's why I'm saying maybe the chase rules would help, you know. But what I'm saying, most of the time I see these as being the four roles on a ship, you know, navigation, engineering, piloting, and gunning. The engineer would also be the person who'd be running like the comms.
Hmm.
Other people can do it too, but it'd be like secondary for them. talking to other ships shouldn't be like something that takes major. I mean, unless you're trying to hack
right.
into some other ships.
Right. Yeah.
If that's a specialty. Okay. That would be hacking, you know, so you could put that under, you know, combat comm tech, you know, where that would be a fifth role, which would be what is the term?
Intrusion countermeasures and
EMC, electronic countermeasure, you know, is where you're either trying to blind their sensors or you're trying to, you know, keep them able to communicate with each other ships and coordinate their effects, or literally trying to get into their ship and take over its functions. So that could be another thing. But what in the example I was given, we weren't doing that. We were just, it was just like ship versus ship combat, and that was or ship versus group of ships combat. That's how I saw that. You have any thoughts on that, guys?
No, I think you broke down the five things. Combat awareness, which might be lumped in with navigation, because you know, not only your, let's see, state of ship, position, heading at other crafts, and that could be lumped in with navigation. So yeah, because where you are relatively and where you want to go.
You need it for both. I think you need it for all these things.
Yeah. First,
if you're not combat aware, you're not going to do a good job navigating.
Yeah, as I said, that's the thing. Those two are kind of lumped together, sort of. Yeah.
They're connected. I'm saying for those who need it, they're going to have to make a combat awareness check first.
Yeah.
And then use that as a modifier for all the other
things. Yeah.
And then together, they make a final modifier for the success or failure of the maneuver versus, because it's going to be an opposed check.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe in Savage Worlds, maybe it's going to be, you know, just, you know, your ship's capacities, you know.
It's been a while. Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen, because if we're going to use Savage Worlds, the Adventure Edition, they still have the previous edition Science Fiction Handbook. They have not, to my knowledge, made a Science Fiction Handbook, but it's reverse compatible. It shouldn't be that much of a problem.
Right, right. Well, but like I said, in these kind of cases, we're talking primarily about opposed roles.
Yeah.
So things like, you know, so there shouldn't be any, the target numbers is your opponent's, you know, result. So it comes down to you coming up with the best result, but how, you know, what's that final thing that's going to be modified? Is it just going to be just a general starship handling that's based upon the ship itself? You know, which I think is fine. I mean, so if all these things turn into bonuses to the starship handling score, because big ships are going to have poorer handling, small ships are going to have better, but they're also going to be more frangible, easier to break up. So, you know, that might be the easiest way of doing it, is just saying, okay, you've got this base score and you're trying to add as many modifiers as possible to it and do that based on the other. So, you know, I think each of these should basically feed to the other. So, like I said, the combat awareness feeds to the navigation feeds to the piloting, you know, and then the piloting, however good it is, the result of that feeds to the weapon fire, okay, and the engineering, of course, you know, feeds to the whatever score that you had for the ship. Is making
yeah.
the ship, you know, its ship may be a 5, but after taking a couple of hits, is now only a 3. But you know, you might be able to overdrive some stuff, bringing it back to a 5, or it's the first round in the ship, and you're really like boosting at somebody. Maybe you can get that up to 7.
We don't need this air conditioning right now. Let's take that down and put some more power into this.
Well, like I said, yeah. you can overdrive certain things, you know, and maybe you know, they say the ship has that Orion booster, you know, maybe for the first round, you know, its maneuverings goes from a 1 to a 3. But, you know, Savage Worlds as a system, you know, you're always trying to hit a 4. Okay, but if you get 4 better than that, it's considered, you know, an ace. And you get a special effect bonus. Okay. But if everybody succeeds in their roles, okay, then usually it's considered like helping. And I think you get a +2 for every success. So I'm just saying, is that all this might add up to like, you know, a plus, and so it'd be a +2 normally, might be a +4 with if you got an ace, you know, and then you add all that to the weapon fire, if that's what you're trying to do, if that's your primary thing is to shoot this guy, then that all adds up to his firing versus their navigation, their piloting. You're firing versus their piloting, and then, of course, if they fire back, it'd be their firing versus your piloting. You know, and, of course, if you're really trying to hit, like, their, you know, their weapons, then, you know, which would be a lot harder to do.
Yeah.
Then, you know, that... I'd like there to be a solution where if you miss the weapon, it doesn't mean you didn't hit the ship. Because most weapons, I don't think, are going to be way out.
Right, yeah.
Like outriggers, they're going to be on the ship. So missing the weapon and not taking it out doesn't mean you didn't do damage to the ship. It's a lot of stuff, you know. So, and I don't see us doing boarding, like, you know.
No.
Going over and you know, taking out a ship by literally going over there. Unless, of course, we literally do that with a stealth type thing. You know, we EVA, you know, and you know, fly over there, you know, and get on the ship and then start sabotaging something or putting mines on their weapons or whatever. And then we come back to our ship and we take off or we boost away and they're suddenly like, oh, you know, let's shoot them. And all of a sudden, boom, 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 you know, things go bad on the ship. But not under, like, you know, space marines, you know, clashing together in space, you know, or with laser beams firing all around us or inside the ship with laser beams firing all around us. So, yeah, that would be interesting. Okay, why don't we talk about what kind of adventures we want to do?
Okay.
Yeah, because that's what one of the questions I had was, like, part of it is like, who do you want to be working for? Are you working for yourselves? Are you working for an organization? Is it a nation? Is it a corporation?
Well, I think it can vary. You know, I mean, there's you know, like some of the movies where they took the ship off and they were supposed to do certain things at certain times, so they had a sensor package that they were supposed to deploy and aim toward a particular thing and record some stuff. That was for some group back on Earth. Okay. But then they were, you know, they were also supposed to do scientific experiments in a pod on the ship, you know, and that was going to another group. Okay. But they were also being, you know, supported by, overall, they were being supported by either a corporation or a government for the purposes of going to this location and either resupplying this area or setting up some new equipment there. So it can vary, you know, depending. It doesn't have to be, you know, a mono cargo is what I'm trying to say. But I would prefer the ship to be owned by us.
Yeah, and we just... And we pick up jobs, okay, oh, this corporation needs this brought to here, or this habitat needs this and need to pick it up and get it back to them. Yeah.
So freelancer taking any jobs and not, yeah.
Yes.
One of the most interesting essays I saw on Firefly was that Mal doesn't realize that the Firefly is actually working for the bad guys. And what and the basis for that was is that they said if you look at the way the show is and the adventures that they go on, essentially the economy of the system doesn't work. You know, they're stretched too thin. You know, they have too many colonies out on distant moons or whatever, and they don't have the supplies they need. And this
usually it's the inner part of the verse that got all the good stuff. If you were right out farther away from the sun, you were kind of on your own and had to have, you know, be a little sneaky to get the really good stuff. You were living a lot more, what's the word, Spartan? Yeah.
So what the government, the inner government needed was they needed a fleet of small ships that could basically go in and solve cargo problems. The crises, okay, you know, and go in where it was most needed, take it, and then, you know, and then come back and pick up another job. So essentially, if they if these people didn't exist, like Firefly, the outer colonies would rise up against the inner colonies because they just weren't getting what they needed in order to survive and prosper.
Yeah.
But because Mal and his group are getting out there so successfully and delivering those just-in-time shipments, they say, well, okay, we're okay now. We don't, you know, and it keeps the lid on that simmering pot. It doesn't get too hot. It doesn't boil over so they're actually keeping a second more successful, possibly more successful rebellion from happening.
They're inadvertently maintaining the status quo.
They're maintaining the status quo, and he never sees it that way. He just sees himself as sticking to the man by being his own man out there. But in fact, that these jobs that he does with being paid for by corporations or whatever like that, they're to keep everything moving smoothly, so all those supplies and mining and all the other things like that keep coming in and supplying the inner worlds. And the big ships, the big cruisers or whatever like that can spend their time mostly going around and dealing with the Reavers, the pirates, or raiders, and larger supply vessels can hit worlds, on a long-term irregular basis. And supply them with large supplies of what they need, and keep things going, because none of these worlds are self-sufficient as far as I can see. They need to be supplied from the inner world, but they don't always get as much as they need, or sometimes they have emergencies where they need specific things, and that's where Mal comes. So yeah, he's maintained the status quo, even though he thinks he's being his own man and sticking it to the man by not working for the man, but he's really working for the man. Was the conclusion that this essay was, and I was like, I had a hard time arguing.
Yeah,
that,
you're kind of looking, not going, being an expert.
Don't tell Mal.
Yeah.
Just keep doing what you're doing and loving your life in pseudo rebellion.
Yeah.
And every year go down and have that bar fight.
Oh, yeah.
No matter what, you're always a cog in the machine.
I don't want to quote the Bible here, but it's like, choose this day whom you're going to serve. Either God or mammon is the actual phrase. Are you going to serve money and therefore the corporate interests, or are you going to serve the higher philosophical thing, God? Yeah. You have to make that decision because you can't do both. So was the point of that particular verse. But anyways, all right. So what can we do, as we work for the man, thinking we're working for ourselves? There is a salvage and rescue, which is kind of nice. It depends on how bad things are out there. If they have had a war, then there's going to be lots of debris fields to salvage and things like that.
Maybe some unexploded ordnance.
You need lots of drones for that. Or be able to have really good discrimination on your sensors. That's a nuclear missile
and
poking its way out of a piece of bulkhead. The ship got blown apart and its missiles, it's still in their tubes, got blown out, so it's kind of sticking out the end of this piece of debris, part of the hull, part of the launch tube, and there's a little nuclear missile in there, and it could just be waiting for a strong enough, so we need to cook that. We need to cook that with our ship's laser rather than, because if we send a drone over there, it may hear, depending on how smart the missile is, hear. Because they're gonna have things like missiles and stuff. They are gonna have countermeasures on them.
Oh yeah.
We're not gonna let anybody. Nobody gets to take us back and use us against our homeland. So all right. So salvage and rescue. Like I said, I think salvage would best be using drones. There's also a rescue, which might involve EVAs, Waldos, or drones. We could have a secondary craft. A captain's skiff, so to speak, which could also be used to take cargo down to a world that has greater gravity, and we can't bring the ship down, assuming the ship cannot land. Okay, or it could just simply be a utility craft, you know, something that basically has a lot of equipment on it, cutting its own power supply, whatever, to go around and do repairs on the ship. But we could also use that to carry us over, so we're not literally doing an EVA in just our chutes. Okay, there's also the question of, is that are we going to have breaching equipment? Okay, are we going to have the ability for our ship to essentially bust into another ship? Because sometimes you have to do that. You know, if the ship doesn't have power, you know, if you can't bring power to the other ship,
you need to get the jaws of life.
Yeah.
It could be anywhere from a package that you basically fire off the ship, trailing a plastic tube that you can inflate with air. Okay, and it hits the other ship, locks onto it, and then plasma cuts through the ship, making an impromptu airlock.
Yeah.
It was not really an airlock, a connection to the inside. And if there is air on the ship, then your ship basically adds air. You know, the tube inflates, and now you have, you know, air between the two ships, and you just go into the other ship. That's one way of doing it. The other way is to bring a breaching package that literally goes over, you attach it to the ship, you cut through the ship, and it has a little tiny airlock, you know, enough for you to go inside, cycle through, and then get in the ship. Or everybody just gets to the ship, closes it, and then they cut through, and now you're inside the ship. You know, again, it's important if they have air in there, you want to get into the ship without. And then the third option is if you have that, or fourth or whatever it is, you have that secondary craft, it could go over and provide enough power to the ship to get the airlocks to power up and work and do whatever.
Yeah. Okay.
You guys have any other ideas along this line?
Nothing I want to reveal now.
I've
got some ideas forming.
I mean, we might need some kind of hacking equipment to basically hack into the airlock if there is power. Because, you know, you may need, like, codes, you know? Codes to get into the ship and make certain parts of the ship work, you know? But, you know, unless the ship manufacturer says, oh, yeah, here's the emergency, you know, codes, which, of course, if you have pirates, they could have those too, so you probably don't want that. So you probably need certain codes in order to go in the ship from the outside.
Each code would have been had to have been made for each ship, and you'd have to call the manufacturer or access and go.
Or maybe the company, whoever owns the ship. Maybe they might have those things before they launched. These were the codes, and if you have them, then you hook onto them, you feed them in there, and the thing cycles and lets you in.
Yeah.
Okay.
And hope that the owners didn't change them after the fact.
If they changed them after the fact, you might have to hack them.
Yeah.
So that's where that hacking comes in. So yeah. How about attaching your ship to their ship, and, you know, like they did in the 2010, where they used the Discovery to actually give the Russian ship extra Delta V, so they could get away from the bad thing that was about to happen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But they were attached. They were physically attached to each other, and then they used explosive bolts to separate them, you know, after the Discovery ran out of fuel, so that it could continue, so at which point it then turned on its engines and continued to accelerate, and the Discovery just kind of floated around in space until the things happened at the end of the movie.
Well, Dave got his ship back. That was what was important.
The humans managed to get back to Earth. That was a good thing.
And Dave got his ship back.
And Dave got to be pals with Hal again, which was a very sweet moment. You know, the second movie had a lot of sweet moments that the first one was sorely missing. It was
completely different director. It made sense.
Really different director, but I'm saying it was very, very stark.
Yeah.
You know, there were some beautiful, you know, space scenes that were gorgeous, okay? But it was so sterile and unforgiving that it was nice to have a lot more. I always recommend to people that they watch 2010. If they had to choose between the two movies, watch 2010. So like I said, but attaching two ships together, unless they're very small. And of course, there's always that other option, which they used recently in Ark, the television show, it's literally a sci-fi show, Ark, where they used the ship's shuttle. They locked it down and they used it to give them a little extra delta V or a little helped it make an important turn it needed to make. Okay, aiming the ship, against the other ship and pushing the ship. So they weren't like giving it speed; they were changing its direction.
Oh, okay.
It's vector, so that it could, because otherwise they weren't going to be able, they weren't going to be able to make get to where they needed to go. They were going to spend all their fuel, kind of arcing there, and they were going to run it. And this way, they could kind of turn a little better. That ship had the Ark had tons of damage to the ship, so there were lots of things that weren't working on it. Theoretically you could have small excursion vessels that were attached to the outside of the spaceship, and if necessary, use them for extra delta V or extra maneuverability. So you know. And you could also use that for if they were like propellant pods, or you could take them off your ship and attach them to like a ship that was damaged too much. The engines were damaged, and use that to propel it toward a port where you could claim the salvage. Because it's always better to take a ship back someplace where it can be fixed up and put back in service than to just strip it down, I would think.
I think it would kind of depend. I could see, you're gonna want to try and bring back the ship, even if it's just a charred out hull. Better to bring it back in one piece and then try and take it apart and possibly lose pieces in the process, or vaporize pieces from the weld, arc welders or whatever.
That's what salvage is about. It's not bringing it all back. That's recovery is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Versus salvage. And then the last thing that I had listed here was, the last thing was for the ship was shipping. So are we going to have cargo containers like they had in FTL 2448, where you just basically just dropped it out of the hold and it had its own little engine on it, and it would fall into the atmosphere and then just, decelerate itself and put out a drone, parachute and land?
I could certainly see that depending on, what cargo and where it's going, you could easily have, if it's going from, say, Earth to Mars.
Well, if you're going to any place that has any kind of gravity, if you drop it on any of the moons of Saturn or Jupiter, they're going to have enough gravity that, and if it's a large container, there's also the ability, the idea of dropping and going.
Yeah.
If you have load whatever's in that container into a secondary ship and then have that land, assuming, of course, they're not going to send their own ships up to meet you. If they're doing that, then it's just a matter of how are you getting it from one ship to another. As you say, that's where that's where those connections between the two ships, they have some kind of a cargo conveyor, and then you just run the stuff across the conveyor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I could see that. Yeah. You could have plenty. I mean, you could easily have some cargo containers that already have thruster packs built in and dumb AI that, just you get into orbit over the selected, destination, and then you drop it and it pilots itself down to its intended destination. But you could also, if you're doing people, you probably don't want to use people for that, because they might not be smart enough to handle people or delicate cargo. These could be things
that's where you'd have to use your other ship. They'd have to send a ship up to meet you, and you'd have to have a secondary craft to go land with that.
But I'd say for bulk simple cargo, ores or gases or liquids that, you know, aren't particularly volatile. You could, just drop it in a drop pod.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of course, there's always docking with a space station or orbital ring to offload cargo. I think that's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it depends on whether you're taking on more cargo, then that means that either they have to send up a cargo pod to you from the surface, or you have to go down with your secondary ship, and pick it up, or mm-hmm. they have to send a ship up to you, and then you transfer it over like we just talked about, okay? I think the biggest issue is, there's also, the different kinds of cargo is, one, information, which may be contained in objects. You could have a big, computer bank that you want to make sure that, you don't want to put it into the memory banks of your ship's computer. So, because you don't want, it might have information that you want anybody else to get. So you don't want any chance of hacking it. So it's completely isolated, it's a completely isolated computer system that's only going to be connected to something if it's stolen physically, or if it's, once it gets to its destination. Or it could literally be information that's just stored on the ship, like ship's mail. That doesn't make sense, because why wouldn't they? If we're just doing the solar system, it seems to me that just regular mail would be faster just to send by communication blazer.
More than likely. You would have basically, from what I'm seeing, a system-wide internet. Just communication satellites and transceivers everywhere, and you could, I'm out at Pluto and I got a communication from Earth. Okay, yeah.
But you wouldn't have any of that instantaneous communication.
No, you wouldn't have that.
There would be some lag, yeah.
A heck of a lot of lag. A few months. In your cloud. But refrigerator frozen products, which could also include people.
Ah.
Those tend to be, if it's people or animals or things like that, those tend to be fairly large because you have to basically maintain it. And the question is that, are they going to be thawed out on your destination, or are they going to be thawed out on your ship? Because if you have a large passenger bay that has a lot of people in tanks, let's say. Those tanks may take a considerable amount of space, and, with all the life support and everything like that, it might actually be a lot cheaper for the shipper, to have you decant them out, revive them.
Yeah.
And then now you can get 20 people onto a small shuttle, where before you might have gotten 3 or 4 tanks. Might be much more efficient to do it that way.
Which means for deliveries, deliveries like that, you would want...
Depends on why they're frozen.
Yeah, if they're criminals, you're probably going to want to decant, do all that at the end. But, because I don't think we're going to have people, layered on top of each other slabs of beef.
Yeah.
Stack
like cordwood, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that... Because you theoretically could do that. If they're literally frozen, with some solution in their body that keeps them from... their cells from rupturing and stuff like that. They're literally in hibernation, then you could theoretically just, pack them like sardines, and then, send the, as you said, send the pod, the can down and have it land, and then they would take them out and then de-thaw them, but that to me sounds like a level of tech that is higher than what we have.
I imagine any actual cryogenics would probably be fairly bulky.
Yeah.
Well, I see that as being something that would be useful for the most the lowest level of reproduction, or for keeping products,
a cold storage unit of some type,
But humans, I could see where they have some form of hibernation where they actually make people go to sleep and stay in a low body temperature where their brains aren't working, but they're still maintaining, their brains are still working, but at a very low level. And so they're taking respiration once a minute, that kind of thing. Heartbeat 5 or 6 times a minute. And that way they, and so, they literally go to sleep on, let's say, Earth, and they wake up in the Oort cloud. It might be 5 months later, but for them, it's just like a night's sleep.
Yeah.
You know, it hasn't been, that kind of like 100 to 1,000 time factor as far as the body process is concerned. I can see that. So, that's why
I can see that. But I think that also be like a luxury. I think that's something that.
Well, if you're sending colonists out, otherwise you have to, like I said, it's not something you do on the interplanetary thing. But when you start heading out really far out, then either you have, like hydroponics, like crazy, because even, you're going to have to stop a couple of times along the way for more fuel, to get where you're trying to go to. And if you want to keep everybody awake,
Well, that's where it comes down to. I think it depends on the funds of whoever is founding said colony. Like if they're a rich and well-funded cult, then... Yeah, they might have a skeleton crew, and they might be able to afford to have the rest of their flock, in hypersleep, or they might just be taking multiple crafts.
Well, I think that's where you're going to have to do the math on your economic system, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to determine that, because to me, obviously having a small crew on the ship awake is important, because the AI is not smart enough to handle unexpected things, okay? Right. So... that means either some of the crew is going to have to be sleeping, okay, and you're going to revolve the crew through the flight, But like I said, on short distances, I don't see any problem about keeping the crew awake for, we've got people up in the International Space Station who've been there for a year, okay, so there's no problem keeping people awake as long as they have enough supplies and stuff. But right. When you talk about a large group of people, that you're like colonists or then it's going, I think some form of hibernation makes a lot more sense, because you're
I think it kind of depends on how the colony forms. If it's all one mass exodus, yeah, that makes sense. But if it's like a slow trickling in,
well, that's, then you're talking luxury again.
Yeah.
Keeping somebody awake who doesn't serve a purpose on the ship. Okay, that's basically a lot of, unless your ships are pretty darn big and
in my mind, I think I think there's a range, because you're going to have some that are, these gigantic,
you decide how that's going to be, because, like I said, on one hand, it sounds like it's really expensive. On the other hand, maybe that's no big deal in this mature, in this mature spacefaring culture, that could be no big deal, because
it could be just like, all you need to do is pay for the materials. Everything else is, free, or, that's something I got to work out as I go through and looking at all this and figuring out how to get what we want out of this.
If you got good recyclers and your ships are airtight, and by that, I mean, the air doesn't migrate through the walls themselves, which is a problem. It's a real thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know,
it does happen.
Yeah. You put a balloon in space, it will eventually become vacuum inside. I should say a ball in space. It will eventually become vacuum inside, because air will percolate through because of the pressure. Very slowly, but it will still do it. Okay. Well, anyways, I think that's as far as we can go. Tonight we'll pick it up in another session, and you can work on this. Hopefully everybody has enjoyed listening to us as we've tried to figure out what would be the best way of doing this.
Yeah, think of this as like the session zero or campaign pitch for
a yeah game.
I say negative one myself.
yeah.
But it's the campaign pitch. It's not session zero, but it's but this is much different than what we did earlier when we said how to make the best space game, because that was essentially talking about it from the standpoint of how to make a fun video game. We're talking tabletop RPG now, so some things can get much more complex because we have the time to deal with it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we don't want to spend all of our time basically, looking stuff up.
Plotting out orbital mechanics. Yeah,
we don't want to do that. just the big strokes on the things that are the most complicated.
And a lot of this is also just our personal tastes as well.
Of course.
So, your mileage may differ.
Everybody is going to have a different idea, So there's always going to be that one thing that somebody's going to say, I absolutely have to have that in my space game.
Well, like when Trav first mentioned, genetic alteration, I was like, okay, so we're going to have cat girls. We're going to have cat girls in space.
Sure!
we'll talk about that in a future session, okay? By the way, I would also point you to our episode on why cats don't rule the world in Hardwired Hinterland, where we talked about where there were all these cats and they were all sentient, and we said why don't they rule the world, because there's so many of them compared to the humans, and there were some really good reasons why cats would not be in charge, and it was a fun episode. I think it's worth the listen. So check that out, because when you uplift creatures and make them humanoid or humans themselves, you don't end up with just a human with funny ears. You end up with a whole thing. So you might want to check that out. Anyways, thanks everybody for listening to us. We've had a lot of fun doing this, and we'll be doing more of this in the future, but you'll have to wait until then.
This is Bruce Sheffer saying, there are a million, million worlds out there, so go explore them.
And this is Trav. There's a reason why it's called gaming. It's for having fun.
Gaming on the Frontier podcast is wholly owned by its hosts. It is released under the Creative Commons 3.0 license. No commercial reproduction and any use of any element of the podcast must be attributed to the Gaming on the Frontier podcast.
Hi, this is Trav from the Travcast. Listen to me Tuesday nights, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on listen.dementiaradio.org/8027.